Okey-doke. Hi, everybody. I'm a recovered compulsive eater. My name is Gary. And don't sit too close to your screen or your monitor. I have a cold. I don't want you to catch it. I'm a recovered compulsive eater. My name is Gary. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I've spoken here before, so I'm sorry my story hasn't changed that much. So if you've heard me before, I apologize, and I've heard it before too. I've been an active member of Overeaters Anonymous since August 1st of 1988. I came in weighing 340 pounds. For those of you in other parts of the world, that's about 154 kilograms and about 24 and a half stone. I've had to learn that because I'm in the virtual region. What happened was I had decided to commit suicide in August. I had been planning this throughout the academic year, August 20, August, I'm sorry, 88, 87 through 88. The weight was a big part of that. 340 pounds is a lot, and it really limited my life. But the bigger part was just I was so angry and miserable and hated life. I hated myself. I didn't know that I hated myself. I knew I hated everybody else. And I was just bitter and miserable. I can't tell you the extent of my misery. I just didn't want, I couldn't live that way anymore. And to tell you how selfish I was, I was we had just moved to Florida. My first wife, God rest her soul, and she is still my second most favorite wife. We had just moved to Florida, where she had no family, and we had a 3-year-old daughter. She's now 41, but we had a 3-year-old daughter. And I was going to commit suicide and leave her alone with no money and no family, and a 3-year-old. But I wanted out that badly. Like I said, I was going to commit suicide. And the reason for August, I'm a retired college professor. So for us, the year starts in August. We go back to work at the end of August. So I had made, in my head, I had made a plan that year that if nothing changed by August, I would commit suicide. And I had a plan. I had made some half-hearted attempts before that, but apparently I lived. And then somehow, August 1st of 1988, I ended up at an OA meeting. I have no memory of how I ended up there, other than an act of providence that God had better plans for me and a place for me to learn and grow. And I ended up here with you guys. And I did not like my first meeting, not one bit. I mean, I knew I belonged there as soon as I, heard and saw what was going on. But it was way too feminine for me. At our last census in 2017, but we do one every 10 years, so we'll be doing another one next year. But the last census in 2017, men were 13% of Overeaters Anonymous. And that's in 2017. So in 1988, we were fewer and farther between. So the meeting was way too feminine. I don't know if you know this, but one of the first symbols for OA was a butterfly. So there were butterflies all over the room, and there was all this hugging and loving you that I just felt like, like, please don't hug me, please don't love me. Go over there and read stuff and leave me alone. But the guy who spoke, and he became my first sponsor, Jeff Grant. You'll probably see him in the Sponsorship Hall of Fame because he was my sponsor for 8 years. He was my sponsor for 8 years. Anyhow, he spoke. He was a speaker, and he spoke about having the obsession removed. And I had never heard that before. In all my, I've done every diet and shots. First time I took Black Beauties, I was 12 years old to prepare me for my bar mitzvah. My parents got me Black Beauties. I was 12, so I could be thin looking for my bar mitzvah at 13. Anyhow, he talked about having the obsession removed, and I was in. I said, I'm in, whatever it takes. Like, have the obsession removed, and that was my goal from the first day, and I'm really fortunate about that. It still is. It still is my goal, that having the obsession removed. I knew then what I know now, that my only hope is if the obsession is removed. that if the obsession is not removed, I'm doomed to binge and binge myself to death. That's what's true for me. And I'm really fortunate, I identify as a recovered compulsive eater, and I know that many of you find that arrogant. I know that because you have told me so in the parking lot. You have said to me, "Man, that's arrogant the way you identify." So I got to figure for every one or two of you who have said that, there's got to be another four or five who think it. And it is true, arrogance is one of my character defects, but not in this. I got to tell you, man, the fact that I'm recovered is one of the most humbling admissions of my life. I can't tell you how. What a gift that is, that God has seen, sought fit to do this for me. What happened was, I had a lifelong sponsor. He died last May. I miss him terribly. And I have a new sponsor now. But through the years, I've gone through the steps with other sponsors all the time. I'm always doing the steps. And one of my sponsors had me read the 10-step promises as an inventory. We have ceased finding anything in anyone, even alcohol. We've been placed in a position of neutrality. We will be, when tempted, we will recoil as alcohol. And so I was checking them off, like, yes, 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 yes. And the big one, we have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. And I'm going to repeat that for any newcomers in here, because this is really the goal. Instead, the problem has been removed. And I got to that, and yes, the problem was removed, and that's why I identify as recovered, so that newcomers will hear the problem gets removed. If you do these things, this is what happened to me. Honestly, I haven't had a craving in decades. I haven't had a craving in decades, and I couldn't stop when I got here. But this, the 10-step promises, and I'm not unique. I know lots and lots of people for whom this has happened. The people who have done the stuff, who have done what I've done and done what they've done, this is what happens. This is the natural results. We call them promises, but they're really just the results. It's like if you turn the steering wheel to the left, the car will go to the left. If you do these things, the problem will be removed. And to be clear, by the problem being removed, it doesn't mean that I can now eat crap and, I can now eat things. That, it means that my desire to eat things that harm me or to engage in eating behaviors that harm me, that desire will be lifted. And it's not because it's something I've done. It's because I put myself in a position to receive that kind of grace from my God or my higher power or whatever you. Anyhow, I'm preaching instead of sharing. I'm sorry. It just this is what happened, and I wish I could take credit for it, but I can't. All I did was what they say to do when you get here. I got here, my first sponsor, this guy Jeff, we went through the steps. I did that first step stuff, and I didn't take a lot of convincing for me to know I was a compulsive eater, to know I was powerless over food. We did that history thing, when you write your story, like Bill wrote his story, I wrote my story, and looking at it was pretty obvious. This is one of my favorite first step story. Some of you have heard it. When I was a kid, I come from a long line of criminals. My parents, my grandparents come from a long, long line of criminals. And I was a criminal as a kid. My father had to leave the country for the federal government was after him. And he had to leave the country and he was living in the Caribbean. And I was a teenager, but in New York, the New York State authorities were going to put me in what they used to call reform school. It's like a jail for teenagers. And so I left the country and I went to live with my father in the Caribbean, and we were living in the mountains up in the, and this is way before like DORA, any of those delivery DORA, grub stuff. And I don't know how people recover when you can have food delivered to you. And, oh my God, oh my God, how do you do that? All you have to do is call somebody up and say, "Bring me food," and they bring you food. Oh my God. Anyhow, we didn't have that, especially in the Caribbean, especially then. And my father, he was going through a thing where he wanted to lose weight because he seemed to have had what I have. And so there was no food in the house. He got rid of all the food. And I was having a carbohydrate craving. And I don't know what it's like for you. When I have a craving, it feels like a need, like I need oxygen. I mean, oxygen. So I had a thought, and the thought was, there's no food in the house, but I need carbs. And we have a German Shepherd, and the German Shepherd has milk bones, and milk bones, they're a dog biscuit. Milk bones are a dog biscuit. And my thought was, oh, those are carbohydrates. And my second thought was, you cannot eat those. That's disgusting. And I was right. They were disgusting. And the second one wasn't any better, nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the fifth. And here's the truth. If I had to wrestle the German Shepherd for them, I would have. Because I needed carbs. I bring this up especially for any newcomers in the room. The reason I ate the dog biscuits was because I was in the grips of a craving, in the grips of a compulsion beyond human aid. That's exactly what it says in our book. I was in the grips of a compulsion beyond human aid. If I had any choice in the world, I would not have eaten dog biscuits. I ate dog biscuits because I had no choice at all. That's what the first step means. That's what it means to be powerless. This thing owned me. What Bill Wilson says in his story, alcohol was my master. Carbohydrates were my master. And I was going to do whatever the hell I had to do to get them. So I'm just saying this, and like, I gotta tell you, eating dog biscuits wasn't in the top 10 of disgusting things I've done. You know, wasn't in the top 10. This is the one I'm willing to share with you. You know, this is the one I'm willing to share with you. So I'm just mentioning this in case you've ever done anything weird with food or something that you're kind of embarrassed about. I'm in the grips of a compulsion beyond human aid. Nobody, unless you could have walked in with some other carbohydrate for me, nothing could have stopped me. So we did the steps together. And from the beginning, I'm so fortunate. The people I fell in with in 1988, the people I fell in with were just, they were 12-steppers. And they taught me from the beginning that the goal, like, abstinence was essential. You know, and I can't underestimate that. Abstinence is essential. It's like, it's where we start. But many of you have heard me say that abstinence is not the goal of recovery. Abstinence is the entry fee. Abstinence is where we start. And this is what I was taught. I was taught right away that the goal is to have the problem removed. The goal is a spiritual awakening of a specific sort, a spiritual awakening which will enable me to not want to eat that crap and not to treat myself poorly, to honor my body. That's the goal. Abstinence, food, is just the first half of the first step. We're only halfway through the first step, I was taught, when we're on to my life, my unmanageable life. And then my relationship to God, to my fellows, to my past. And when I got here, honestly, if this was some sort of Charles Manson cult, I would have joined. I was desperate. If when I got here and they said to me, in order to recover, you have to pillage and plunder, I would have pillaged and plundered. Like I said, I was already a criminal. Like, if I had to beat you up and rob you or something, yeah, I would have. But here's what they told me I had to do. I had to trust God and love my fellows. I had to trust God and love my fellows. Neither of those things were easy. Neither of those things were or remain easy. Trusting God is something, you know, I've always heard that you can't have faith and fear at the same time. I've always heard that, and that's always made sense to me. It's just not my experience. My experience is when God calls for me to do something, when God calls me to act out in service, to take on a new service position, it scares the something out of me. What's a better word? It scares the bejesus out of me. Is that a word? Yeah, it scares stuff out of me. It scares me terribly. When I'm called to act out in faith, I'm usually called out to do something new, and it scares me. Some of you know I've done and do a lot of service in Ovaries Anonymous. I've never felt qualified. I've never felt good at it. Usually, by the time I'm comfortable in a position, it's time to move on. Anyhow, So we did the first step. We got to the second step, and I argued with my sponsor a lot about God. I wasn't an atheist. I wasn't an agnostic. I wasn't a believer. I was just extremely obnoxious. And I'm still pretty obnoxious 37 years later, nowhere near as bad as I was. But he believed in God, so I was going to argue with him why there's no God. Not because I believed that. I just liked arguing. He was just a great sponsor. He didn't argue with me. He said, "Look, I don't give a hoot what you believe." He didn't use the word hoot, we're two guys, but you can get the gist. He said, "I don't give a hoot what you believe." He said, "You're an active addict. So God hasn't chosen to reveal the nature of the cosmos to you, Moses." He said it just like that. Like, who do you think you are? He said, "If you want to get well, come to believe this. People who get well come to believe this. No big thing. If you don't want to believe this, it just means you want to eat more than you want to get well." He said it that simply, which makes sense. It's not a surprise that a compulsive eater wants to eat more than they want to get well. And for any of you who struggled, especially in the beginning, resistance to recovery is part of the recovery process. You know, we all resist recovery. If we didn't, you would come to an OA meeting, you would get well, and we would have to charge a hell of a lot more. You know, this would be magic. It is mystical, but it's not magical. You know, resistance to recovery is part of the deal. He said, "If you want to get well, come to believe this." He said, "Start looking for evidence of a loving God." And that's what I did. I just started looking for evidence of a loving God, and I still do that. To this day, I get stuck in a red light and I start realizing, well, God's probably saving me from an accident on the other side of this light. I just start looking for evidence, even if I'm making it up. Turns out it doesn't matter. Even if it's imaginary, it doesn't matter. I started looking for evidence of a loving God and I started finding it everywhere. Where I live half the year in Florida and half the year in Chicago. And where I live, there are egrets and ducks and iguana and right in my backyard. And where I live in Chicago, my view is of Lake Michigan. Like there's my terrace, and then there's the horizon. There's water. In the, like I'm surrounded by. How can I not believe in God? How can I not find evidence of a loving God? I have a granddaughter. My daughter, that 3-year-old girl I was telling you about when I came in, she loves me. We're really close. I'm happily married. Happily married. I always thought that was an oxymoron. But I'm happily married. You know, I have creative outlets. Overeaters Anonymous has given me a place where my skills, my talents, my interests can all be fired. Like I said, I do a lot of service because there's a place here where, like, I didn't know how to balance a checkbook till I became a treasurer. I didn't know how to use a computer till I was a newsletter editor. I didn't know how to negotiate a contract until I started chairing conventions. I've learned so much like basic practical stuff, let alone all the spiritual wonders of working with others and growing with others. And man, OA is just a great place to grow up. Anyhow, we got to the third step. And he and I, we got on our knees and we prayed together. And in the big book, it says some of us had a great effect at once upon having done a third step. And I'm one of those. I did have a great and deep spiritual experience upon taking the third step. I've also had the educational time that goes on. A lot of us want that white light experience, but I'll remind you that Bill Wilson had that white light experience. And 6 months later, he's in a hotel lobby going back and forth between the bar and the phone booth. And it could have gone either way. Those white light experiences are good for the day. You know, most of us here have had at least one good spiritual experience. 3 months later, they don't help us much. They're good for the day. Yesterday's spiritual experience does not help me much today. I've got to do this daily. I'm preaching again. Sorry. Anyhow, we did the third step. And here's what happened for me. It did make the sky bluer and the grass greener and all that. But more importantly, like I said, I had been a criminal a good part of my life. And all of a sudden, the third step for me was a decision to try to live by spiritual principles. It didn't mean I succeeded, but I was at least going to try, and I've been trying ever since to live by spiritual principles. And that decision alone, that act, changed who I was. All of my life I had been looking to see what I could get away with. And now all of a sudden I was like, what the principles guiding my life weren't what could I get away with, they were what I could I contribute. And it just changed who I was and made me a different and a better man. God, this program and you people, you have not just saved my life, you have given me a life worth living. If there's ever anything I can do to return the favor, please let me know. My phone number is in my little Hollywood Square box. Don't hesitate to use it. Thank you for letting me share.